Carol. Ready? Good morning. We are convening today's Revenue Committee, and we're going to start with some business that's sort of been there that we haven't gotten to, which is work session on House Bill 3261. Committee members, this was a bill, which staff have we got for this one? I think it's Chris's. I'm opening a work session officially on House Bill 3261, which has to do with the issuance of tax warrants. If you recall, sorry, staff, we have a little emergency here. Since Paul is pinch hitting, I pushed getting us open because Lori, we had a quorum so early, and I wanted to reward you, committee members, for being here so early. Okay. Paul, do we have the fiscal and the revenue impact?
Madam Chair, yes. 3261, as you recall, you've heard it. We scheduled a work session. We're waiting on the fiscal. You have no revenue impact, and you have a minimal expenditure impact.
So
the bill provides for the issuance of tax warrants without Department of Revenue direction to the county sheriff to seize and sell taxpayers' real and personal property.
And this is part of that efficiency piece?
Yes, this actually brought to us by Representative Barnhart.
Okay.
And do we have a dash two?
No. We do have a dash two.
I think you have you adopted that.
Do we?
Yes, the dash two. The amendments apply to the dash two.
I haven't seen that, the dash two.
Here's
my
Christine.
Problem. I feel I don't have a copy of the most recent amendments.
Is there a dash two?
Apparently they can't, so.
I'm glad you noted, because Christine, do we have a dash two for that? As if you don't have an.
Had we already adopted the dash two in the prior?
Did we already put the dash twos into the bill?
There is the dash.
Okay, it was introduced, but it hasn't been adopted.
Correct.
And it replaces the bill.
The dash two does replace the bill. Correct, and it requires the Department of Revenue to send a mailing to the taxpayer.
That's a dash one.
A dash one. But there is a dash two amendment.
I'm going to, members of the committee, I'm going to close the work session and carry this over to Friday, Paul. Until we have a look at the dash twos, we may be premature, and I'm not ready to move a bill without having that dash two in front of us. Carol, did you get that? We're closing the work session. Let's try it again. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2550A.
Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2550A, as you recall, expands the current intergovernmental agreement, reciprocal agreement between the Oregon Department of Revenue and the U.S. Financial Management Services, the IRS, beyond tax refunds to include other federal payments. You have in your packet the fiscal statement, which does have a fiscal for the 11-13 biennium, and then moving forward, and that cost in 11-13 is about $200,000 in other funds, and ongoing, beginning with a 13-15 biennium of $100,000. And you also have a revenue impact statement that shows a revenue gain in 11-13 of about $400,000, and then increasing gradually to $3 million in the 15-17 biennium. And this would be due to increased collections by expanding this agreement, and the revenue is for other funds. and the revenue impact statement, we don't have solid information on exactly who would be affected by this, because it depends on the people who have outstanding debt and are in these financial situations. So the revenue impact is basically a share of the experience with the current Treasury offset program, and it's about 10%. The collections from this would be about 10% of that. So there's definitely some variance in those numbers, but that's ultimately the revenue impact of the $3 million. The gradual increase from $400,000 to $3 million is kind of a ramping up of the program.
Okay. Is the revenue impact statement net of the fiscal, or are they standalone?
They stand alone.
Okay.
Stand separate.
Questions for Chris?
And we're dealing with the A version?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Which
we have.
Which is what came to us.
Right.
Was the A version.
Right. Correct. Are you ready for a motion?
Yes. I think we're ready for a motion. Thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2550, A engrossed version, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barnhart moves House Bill 2550, A engrossed, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think I'll call for a roll call vote.
Representative Dennis.
Madam Chair, yeah, were we going to have any discussion on the motion before that?
If you'd like to discuss the motion, I ask for questions. Call for questions. You're a hair late, but I will entertain questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for your indulgence. We are talking about HB 2550.
Yes.
And I think I raised a question at the last hearing, and Deborah Buchanan responded to that question. The question was, if a bank had taken a security interest in a flow of payments, and then this offset was worked, would the bank's security interest be protected? And the answer, I think, is no. It would not be protected, and the offset would be worked before that which remained following the offset, if anything, would make its way out to the bank. And so I'm a little surprised we haven't heard from banking interests regarding this, but perhaps it's not too surprising because it's kind of a subtle issue, and maybe it doesn't rise very frequently. But I'm going to vote for the bill, but my concerns, I'm hoping if there are banking groups that are opposed to it, they will bring it up in the Senate.
Thank you, Representative. Well stated.
Representative Dunn.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Brewer.
Excused.
Co-Chair Barnhart.
Aye.
Co-Chair Brewer.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Benz, would you care to carry this bill on the floor?
I would be happy to.
Thank you, Representative Benz. We appreciate that. members of the committee, what next? Which way do you want to? A bill introduction. I'm going to open a work session for the introduction of a committee bill. Representative Barnhart.
And close the work session.
Oh, I've got to. Thank you. I've got to close the work session on House Bill 2550A and open a work session for bill introduction, which we are passing out now.
As we go. Okay. Madam Chair, I move the introduction of LC 4120, dated 4/2011, as a committee bill.
Representative Barnhart moves LC 4120, dated 4/2011, as a committee bill. Go ahead.
And Madam Chair, I simply note for the record that it's been historic for this committee since the time of Chair Shetterly to introduce committee bills without reference to a person's particular position on the bill. Voting to allow it doesn't suggest that one supports the bill or opposes the bill or has any particular thoughts about the bill at all. That is a courtesy to the person who presented it to us.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart. Committee members, any objection to the introduction? So ordered. Okay. I'll sign. Next, Paul. We're going to go to... Okay, I'm closing the work session for bill introduction and opening for further discussion, a work session on House Bill 2328A, which is the EV vehicle bill. We will not be working it, members of the committee, because we have maybe possibly other things that might, little tweaks. But Mazin is here to talk about its current configuration, and we will get a chance to kind of ask whatever questions that you might want to bring forward at this point. So, Mazin, you want to go through where we are on this bill?
Thank you, Chair Berger. The EV... Is that the evil bill?
No.
Madam Chair, it seems like this morning with the accidents and stuff, like we've entered into a vortex. So the best thing to say is star date 04272011.
Yes, it's numbers.
House Bill 2328, A in votes, you have at this point. On Monday, it was scheduled for a work session, and we had in front of you in the packet at that time three amendments, for the copy, the A9, 10, and 11. The 11 is the one that would be the most inclusive of all of these. And the A11 primarily does a few things for the bill itself. It does not, of course, change any of the concept. The concept is still to find a way, a structure to allow for mileage fee, and that mileage fee would be the way of finding payment by the vehicles that don't use fuel for their propulsion, or it does fuel but not gasoline, to contribute to their share of the highway costs. At that time, when you discussed the bill, there was different reactions about the issues of the enforcement and what type of enforcement that there was in the bill. And I think many of the reactions to that it was probably premature to start talking about these enforcement when we don't know what the system is going to be. So the Dash 11 amendments, first thing that they do is they take most of those penalties and punitive processes out of the bill. It only allows or keeps the issue of reporting vehicle miles and having that as a Class A violation. Everything else with the penalties and taking away your car and so on is all that out of the bill in the A11. So that's one thing. The other thing the A11 includes in them is an idea of, first, a policy declaration at the beginning, or a bunch of whereas statements in order to make the idea clear in the bill that this is a construct, if you will, for the constitutional type of collection of the fees, and the same time that the legislature is allowing for the encouragement of those vehicles by allowing for a rate that is transitional, and then in 2018, a rate that is permanent. The transitional rate that you put in the bill in starting 2015 is an 85 cents per mile, and that will go on until the year 2018, where you would go to $1.56.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes.
But I'm I'm stuck on the decimal point problem again. And I've noticed that several people in our room noted the same problem. You said, Mazin, 85 cents per mile, and I think what you meant was 85 hundredths of a dollar, 85 hundredths of a cent.
Yes, I did. Yes. 8.5 mils.
0.085, correct?
Mils.
No,
yes.
0.0085.
0.085.
A bit less than a penny.
We're used to dealing in billions. It's hard to deal in very small
numbers. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You've caught a couple of these, and you're absolutely right. So it's point, for the record, point... 0.0085 cents or...
Dollars.
Yeah, what's less than a penny per mile.
Less than a penny per mile. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
85% of a penny. That's 8.5 mils per mile.
Thank you.
A good one. Mils per mile.
There we go.
And since we deal with mils in the weight mile tax, that should be an easy transition for all of us, I guess.
Okay.
The rate goes to 1.56 cents per mile on July 1st, 2018.
Okay.
The A11 still allows for the department to go and find the Department of Transportation to find a way or the best way for the collection, utilizing private industry and private vendors and so on. And it also continues to allocate the money on 50-30-20 requirement between state, cities, and counties, or state, counties, and cities, counties being 30%. And it also, at the end, there was some reaction to the reporting period, whether it makes sense of on a monthly basis or quarterly basis and so on. And that was left in the bill to be by rule based on what type of choice the consumers would choose. So it will give people choice of how they would like to report their miles. And finally, it makes the applicable date for the which model years of vehicles. So the one that first applies in July 1st, 2015 would apply to the 2016 model year. And then when it becomes, that's the transitional rate time, when the full rate or the normalized rate, as we're terming it in this bill, comes in July 1st, 2018, that will apply to all model years. And the final thing that you wanted in the committee is the reports by the Road User Task Force to come back and report on the implementation of the system. So that was put in also the last section of the bill to have reports to the transportation as well as the revenue committees on the system. That's what's new with the A11 amendment. And if you don't have the hard copy in front of you, it is on your S drive access that you can do with your computer.
Questions? Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And this may be a question for now, maybe a question for when we have the final amendment.
Now is the time to get things teed up if we want them in the final amendment.
Thank you. In that spirit, I think it would be very helpful for the committee to see in detail how that the charge was arrived at, that 1.56, the normalized rate, what that methodology is, just so we all understand why that is where it is and the transitional rate and how that leads to that 1.56 cents.
I have a feeling that Mazin anticipated that.
I hate to disappoint you, Chair Berger, so I did anticipate it. and I have a handout that's, I'll just pass this way instead of
That's fine.
Normal way.
Thank you.
And just to be clear about how we did it, we actually did this thing in two different ways. First of all, the highway, the traditional highway cost allocation model actually provide us with a model that gives us a way to manipulate rates and change things around, and that is a computerized model that actually lives on my desktop. And what we did is assume that there will be a time, 1 year, that we will go to the vehicle miles that everybody starts paying in order to be cost responsible, as if we would pay for the system the same way we are paying for it today. Now, that came to us with that rate. Now, we took that rate and checked it against what we call the new efficient fee methodology. And this is the paper that you have in front of you. And if you scroll all the way down to the last section that you have, where you have cents per mile box, this little guy here.
The bottom box.
The bottom box turns all of your fees that would be paid by users of the highway system, of the road system, into an efficient fee. Now, that includes registrations, titles, fuel tax, fee structure is turned into what we call the efficient fee. An efficient fee, if you imagine, and that goes with the vortex type of star date, if you imagine that kind of thing, you would have a per mile charge that would change based on the congestion and on different. So this is the future in 25 years or so, if you get to it. In that sense, the last column in that table, you would have the average efficient fees. These would be the efficient fees that would cover all the other fees. And you would have them by weight class. So the 1 to 10,000, and these are the your typical vehicles type, would be required to pay an efficient fee of 2.93 cents. That will cover all their costs that they need to shoulder for the highway system. Now, of course, with these type of vehicles, the advantage that they're introducing to atmosphere or to the construct of finance, public finance and highway finance, is that their emission fee is a lot less, or the emission impact or pollution impact on the environment is a lot less than your typical vehicle that you have today. And next to the average emission fee, you would see that the emission fee for that class of vehicle, the 1 to 10,000, is $1.09. Back to that same problem, 1.09 cents. So if you imagine that you would give back a credit to those vehicles because they're polluting a lot less than your average vehicle today, you're down to about 1.87, something like that, for your average efficient fee. However, although these vehicles are clean and they emit a lot less, they still have to get battery replacements and energy and so on. So they don't exactly get all the credit, not the 1.09 all credit. And then you put back the some percents per car, per vehicle, for the continuation of the vehicle title fee and vehicle registration fee, because that's not going to go away. And that's where you pair it back down to the $1.56, not dollars, per mile. So in summary, we came to it from the traditional highway cost allocation model, and we checked it against the efficient fee model, and that's basically where we arrived at the 1.56.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Manager. So if I understand correctly, so the average efficient fee is 2.93 cents We're subtracting most of the emissions fee out of that and then taking the registration fees and other fees that are already paid off the top, which then leaves us with 1.56 for the permanent rate. The transitional rate of 0.85 cents or 8.5 mils is a how is that number arrived at?
I think that number was arrived at based on average miles per or miles per gallon MPG in a certain year that at the time of 2015, I believe, and just to make it give it the highest efficient vehicle type and giving that so. Basically, it is at a time to say that we will not charge these vehicles more than anything that is being performed at the highest level of MPGs today.
Thank you, Madam Fisher. So the intention there with the transitional fee is to say, with these new vehicles that are coming online that may not be or that aren't will not be paying into the gas tax revenue system for maintenance and repair, that they will come online at the highest efficiency of current vehicles that are on the road that are paying into that as a way to help ease that transition into the overall system that we're looking at for vehicles. Is that a correct summary?
That's correct.
Thank you.
I think you've very well summed up the thinking on that. Yes. Representative Warren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, as I understand it, the biggest wear and tear on a road isn't the number of tires that roll over top of it. It's the weather. And keeping that in mind, it seems counterintuitive to me that we would have a congestion fee. Typically in economics, when you have twice as many people consuming the same substance or the same area, the cost of replacement is spread out over more individuals, and therefore the cost goes down on a per individual basis. So my question for you is, when you're talking about a congestion mileage fee and kind of a bump, where do we have that policy discussion about whether that is the appropriate policy for the state of Oregon? Is that here, or is that something that's coming later?
Senator Vaughn, the congestion fee, the way the constitutional requirement for allocating costs by the highway system is done through the highway cost allocation process. Now, having said that, House Bill 2001 also tagged the Department of Transportation and the whole process, if you will, saying the highway cost allocation process shall do an efficient fee methodology. And the efficient fee methodology basically says, what if you have a way of charging for the use of the road that is not based primarily on one form of fee versus another? So in front of that discussion, you have a number of things that you have to consider. Now, there are certain type of vehicles that, as we look at them, the 1 to 10,000 pound vehicle, their impact on the road is primarily if they're by weight and wear and tear, they really don't tear up the road. I mean, they're basically, for most part, are compacting. Compacting the asphalt, if you will. What they add, however, to the system is congestion. Now, if in the economic system, if you have supply and demand perfectly aligned, you would have markets clear, which means if the transportation or mobility is a commodity and you're allowing it to move with markets, you'll never have congestion because everything will be perfectly aligned to the right price. And you'll always be able to go from point A to point B at the most optimal rate because you're paying the most optimal rate or the most optimal fee. And that's the idea with the average with the efficient fee. If you charge the most optimal fee for the transportation system and you're allowed for that fee to change, you would give the section of the average fee for the congestion fee in order not to make it underpayment, which reduces congestion, because if it's cheap, everybody wants the same commodity and comes in, and then you have a glut. And if it's too expensive, nobody wants it, and you have open roads and you're building for non-efficient system. So that's where this efficient fee type of idea is. Where is that? Because we know how many vehicle miles of travel does exist in Oregon, because that is measured every year. And we know how many vehicles there are, how many lane miles, what is the demand, if you will, for the transportation system to do. So this is, in a way, the efficient fee economic estimate for that.
Just one follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. That makes a lot of sense. One of the shortcomings of economics is the way that it affects real people. And we talk about price and demand inelasticity, and we talk about, you know, whether or not a price is at the optimal place. What it forgets is that many of the people that are in the congested areas that have to travel further to get to work in the morning, they don't have a flexible schedule, and they live that far away because the housing is cheaper farther away, because the wealthy are able to live within 5 minutes of where they work, and they have, the irony is, they have the money to pay the congestion fee in the first place. And so I'm very concerned about the notion of a congestion fee and how it would impact the $2,000 a month or less, you know, file clerk working downtown that lives in Gresham. So I'm very concerned about that, but thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair.
Representative Vaughn, you know, also.
I'm going to let the economist speak to this, Representative Vaughn. I know you were making a statement more than a comment, but.
The only thing is just I feel like the urge to defend my profession here.
I love economists.
I think many things in economics might not work as well as we assume them to be, but there is one thing that we know that works, which is pricing. Price works. So when you price a commodity between supply and demand and so on, you're able to align that. So whether it's true, once you introduce something to to a market, and if you start the introduction with a limited amount of units, if you will, in order for that not to cause a problem and not to start a different cycle, you have to price it at a level that is commensurate between the supply and demand. Now, there are different social implications to what you introduce at what time and how long does it take. And the transition between Nirvana or Star Date and where we are today takes several steps, and those steps come in different ways. Today we do have a system for financing the highway system, and also we price that system and allocate the cost. And if you remember the highway cost allocation presentation that you had, this is what we call the traditional method. We know how much needs to be paid and how it is paid today, and we try to allocate it between the different types of vehicles. So we are able to evaluate what exists today. And even doing that, we still get to the price that we have now. Now, we checked with the efficient fee. We don't have an efficient fee system today. I mean, that's for sure. But we checked against the what would needs to be in the efficient fee in the future, and try to come to a kind of collaboration between the two statements. So saying, in other words, if we had an efficient fee and those new vehicles that are coming with the futuristic point of view, which of course they're still very high in price because of the supply and demand and the production. And, I mean, I'm sure by 20 years from now, electric vehicles are not going to be $35,000 a year. So that's how we consider this, and this is not to indicate by no means that this is only open for people who you know with a certain level of income versus, because we do, if you remember also the presentation that we had at one time, equity is one of the things that we always look at when the economic distribution of who finances the road and how they finance the roads.
Representative Pence.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Two thoughts. The first one in a follow-up on the conversation enjoined. The Mazin, is it correct? Could we have or maybe you have available a breakdown of this analysis that does not, that is not based on the efficient fee?
Yes.
Do you have that also available for us?
I do have it. I don't have it available for you, but I have it in the other page, and I probably will make it available. I'll either send it to you or you, but you should have a copy of that. If you're looking in your records, and some and the one that when we presented the highway cost allocation, these are the results of the traditional study.
And, Co-Chair.
Yes.
And is the fee that is now in the dash 11 based upon the efficient fee or upon what's the proper descriptive phrase for the other
traditional method?
Traditional, or is it based on the traditional method? Which is it?
Actually, it's based on the traditional method. What we've done with the efficient fee is check whether this would continue to be an efficient fee. And why that works, if you remember, one of the main assumptions that we did with the efficient fee is we said whatever comes out of the efficient fee will be used for the construction, maintenance, and taking care of the highway system that we have. So we did not allocate any of the vehicle payments to, let's say, mitigation of pollution and so on. So we assume that the constitutional requirement for all these fees to be spent on the roadway, on the highway, still continues to be the rule of the day. So that's why we're able to crisscross.
Representative Pence.
Right. It occurs to me that we need to stick with the traditional method, and it's interesting to compare the efficient fee to the outcome of the traditional method, but for all the reasons we're all aware of, we need to have this based upon the traditional method.
Yes.
And so there's no confusion that we somehow have made some sort of a
jump.
Exactly. Because yeah. I don't want to make that jump personally, right. And I would not for many reasons. So that's number one. Number two, Madam Co-Chair, it strikes me that if we're going to make some proposed changes to the Dash 11s, the one that would be of greatest interest to me, and I think it would be helpful to lots of folks, is if we had a flat fee option. And that I mean a folks could who have these electric vehicles could choose to go ahead and use the nicely designed system that's in the bill, but for maybe the same period of time that exists between now and 2018, they could have a flat fee, which Mazin would have to make the call on, would have to fit the constitutional mandates of equity. So how we could do that, we'd have to ask. But to me, that would resolve 80% of the concerns the electric vehicle operators have expressed to me in emails and otherwise. It could not go on forever for many reasons, but in the short run, 5 to 6 years, it seems to me it would be a worthwhile option for us to discuss.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mazin, I'm trying to remember back to the presentation that we had in front of this committee on the highway cost allocation study. If I recall correctly, there was a pretty nice alignment between the traditional method and the efficient fee method. They came out with almost exactly the same result. Is my memory correct on that?
That's correct.
Thank you.
As it happened, I think that we can come with an amendment as suggested by Representative Bence, and I would ask Mazin to propose a fee that would be as reflective during this transition period. Okay. Any further questions or comments? Committee members, I think that we have a number of goals here, and particularly in the Dash 11, the whereas statements I think are important in discussing what we're trying to get to. And nowhere in there does it say we're trying to punish people who have purchased one of these vehicles, and that's part of the reason that I kind of would like to de-emphasize any of the penalty pieces in here other than, you know, accurately trying to record their miles and not trying to game that system. But I don't think that that's what people are going to do. I think that the owners of these vehicles are already showing themselves to be sort of visionary and innovative in their thinking, and I think in some sense they might embrace this very much so, because it is some new thinking in transportation. And I will also tell you, in looking at this, Oregon's unique weight mile system, which very few states have, put us in a position to look at this very differently than most states, because we're partway there already with the big trucks. And so it makes for an interesting juncture. Representative Juan.
Just one last issue I wanted to ask about. Is it the case that this mileage fee, whatever it becomes in the future, is that intended as a policy matter to be our sole source of revenue for the roads?
Yeah, if it works.
Well,
yeah.
Could I comment on that, Madam Chair? There are a number of other options that are being developed right now. You know, when the automobile first started, there were half a dozen different motive systems. They used steam engines. They used internal combustion engines. They had electric cars back then, 100 years ago. And I suspect the same thing's going to happen again right now, as the internal combustion engine and powered by gasoline becomes less popular for a whole bunch of reasons. The electric battery system is one method. The gasoline electric system that the Bolt uses is going to be a different method. I expect that if the German auto companies are right, hydrogen is going to be a big method. I think we already have in place a system for charging what amounts to a hydrogen tax based on the current constitutional requirement that taxes applied to materials that are used to power cars on the road come under the highway fund. And I think we already have that in our statute. So I would be kind of astounded if anytime soon we got down to the point where this was the only source of funding. Because if you put a hydrogen pump in at the service station and fill up your BMW fuel cell car with hydrogen, one presumes you'll pay the hydrogen fuel tax that's comparable to the gasoline tax now based on the statute we already have.
Mr. Chair, or not, depending on how we...
unless we decide to go completely to a usage fee.
Yes, I don't think the answer is here. I think the future is before us to see how this might work. Did you have a further comment?
Just a further comment, and this is just a kind of a general statement. I'm always uncomfortable with relying exclusively on a user fee to fund something in government that everybody benefits from, whether they use it or not. And that's why I asked the question. I mean, even if you are homebound and cannot drive, you derive a benefit from the transportation system that we have. And so I'm not saying this is enough for me to man the barricades and fight the death against this bill, but I just wanted to throw out that concern that I have about user fees in general, and I see this system being possibly dangerous in the sense that folks that don't drive don't pay anything, even though they are deriving a tremendous benefit from an excellent transportation system. So I want to make sure that that's on the record.
Go ahead.
Well, and of course, the The simple response to that is that if you buy goods and services that require transportation over the roads, somebody's paying the cost of the user fee, whether it's a gasoline tax or whether it's a user fee like this one. And one presumes that the price you would pay for those goods or services would reflect the cost of that purchase.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this last interchange and discussion is exactly the reason we're lucky to have an Office of Innovative Partnerships to be thinking about these things, and the very reason and the very sort of thing that the Transportation Committee and the Revenue Committee should be thinking about long term. So I'm glad this is just one example of the kind of thing we're thinking about. We don't know what's going to happen, and that's the appropriate role for us to think about, talk about, and plan for.
Further questions?
Sure.
Yes.
This is almost comes to my mind, Madam Chair, because this is a new thing that we're doing. It's like one small mile for a vehicle and one huge mile for a vehicle kind.
vehicle kind.
That, as they say, was a groaner.
Madam Chair, yes. Mazin is particularly good at neologisms.
Yes. I really deeply appreciate this discussion. The future is before us. I was introduced to this when I first came in, and somebody said, well, you ought to go visit the Rough Tough Committee, the Road User Task Force Committee. And it became clear to me that while at one point in our history, the price of a gallon of gasoline very closely mirrored the costs. You could the more you drove, the more you paid. It was a very nice vehicle, if you will, if excuse the pun, for a user fee. But it's also clear that that is not going to be the case in the future, that the entire industry is changing. Our whole sort of look at the costs are changing. And this bill, I think, speaks to what our forward-looking sort of answer. And I really appreciate the discussion. If there's anybody else, yes, Representative.
Just a quick one. First, I want to make certain that the DOT has had a chance to look at the Dash 11s. And within the realm of what we've discussed, it works, given what we've talked about. That would be useful.
Why don't we ask Director Garrett
and
Whitty to come up.
And while they're coming, I think the only change we're talking about in the 11s is the flat fee the transitional flat fee that Representative Bentz suggested. I don't think we're talking about anything else for the Dash 12s.
No. The Dash 12s would only, at this point, include some
that
sort
change.
Of... That change. Is that...
Anybody... have other things. Maybe we should ask them what their views are, because they may have some other things that need to be fixed.
I think, Madam Chair, I'll defer to Mr. Whitty here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Whitty, manager of the Office of Innovative Partnerships at ODOT. I think that the flat fee option is workable within the framework of what is already in the bill and the Dash 11 amendments. It will not have a negative revenue impact to the department. There may be different collection costs. We have to figure that out, but I think it'd probably net out at least. And I think it also goes to the philosophy that was discussed in the two hearings of having motorist choice. I think it is consistent with that, so it could be a positive change in the bill.
And what I'm interested in finding out specifically is whether, with that one exception that we've been discussing, the Dash 11s gets at the issues that we've been talking about as far as you're concerned. And I'm interested also in any potential drafting errors, because I'm hoping that we're getting very close on this bill.
Madam Co-Chair and Co-Chair Barnhart, I think the Dash 11s take a step towards resolving or at least calming down some of the issues that the electric vehicle advocates and owners have expressed. And so I think we're getting closer. There is one little thing I want to bring up with Legislative Council.
But that's the reason I asked the question.
In the bill, it's kind of hard to explain. What we put in the concept for the Dash 11s didn't quite translate perfectly. And it's a detail. If you want to hear it, I'll go over it. But I think we can correct it. It essentially has to do with the word compliance. They determined that to be payment when actually we probably meant reporting.
Okay.
So that's the kind of detail.
Ah, okay.
It would be very helpful if those be caught.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's the last one.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that's the reason I raised the question is I'd like to, if it's possible, to get the thing done so that the next rendition includes a transition flat fee, as we discussed, but also any other technical fix that we need to make so we're done with it.
Yeah. Agreed.
Director Garrett, you want to weigh in on this?
No. Madam Chair, I appreciate the conversation. I think you captured it well. We are at a hinge point in the way we fund transportation.
For the record.
For the record. Matthew Garrett, Director of the Department of Transportation. Thank you. But we are at this hinge point. And while we want to move quickly, I completely concur with Co-Chair Barnhart. We don't want to move with haste because this is a big step.
Thank you.
And that's precisely why I wanted to hear from you this morning.
Further question or discussion? Thank you very much. To be continued, and I'm going to carry over the work session on House Bill 2328A to Friday and close the work session on House Bill 2328. And I'm going to take up House Bill 20, open a work session on House Bill 2543. This is the senior deferral program, and we're very close on this one, members of the committee. We have just one small issue left to resolve in terms of first place on liens, and I think other than that, we're very close. So, Christine?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2543, the Dash 3 amendment, makes a couple of changes. First of all, it allows the Department of Revenue increased authority to collect any outstanding liabilities from any of the transferees or heirs after a participant still owes money. And so that enables them to do that, just kind of a technical change. And the amendments, the Dash 2 and the Dash 3, also incorporate a 5% cap on new participants from the 2011 year. So it allows for a 5% growth. This would be based on projected population growth of those ages 65 and over. And as you can see, the cash flow implications of that, it helps to keep funds into the program by capping the payments out, the new liabilities. And we have just gotten in the Dash 3 amendment officially. But we don't have a fiscal impact statement on that quite yet.
It's hot. It's still warm from the copier.
Yes. And also, we're handing out a list here of the changes that were made in the amendments, and I've added the last two items there are changes that came through with the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments, which include that 5% cap, as well as the additional authority for Department of Revenue to collect from heirs and transferees. And one of the items, this is the table that we went through in the previous work session on the Dash 2 amendment, and there is a item number 11 that might still be up for some debate that would involve getting priority for the liens that would be the same as tax liens, and in cases it would be ahead of the mortgage companies in the case of default, and that item might still be up for discussion because it was kind of got through the process in the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments.
Yes.
Madam Chair, just to address that that particular item, I know there's been some discussion about it, especially among those who write mortgagees who are concerned about that issue. It seems to me, and I know you and I have discussed this, that we get a substantial protection from moving the qualification from the moment you buy your house to 5 years later, so that it doesn't become, so that the tax deferral doesn't become part of the initial financing plan for the purchase of a house. And I think that was one of the concerns. And in my view, this is an area where we can reduce the nervousness of the mortgagee community, if I can put it that way, by removing, by not moving this to a tax lien, but simply keeping it the way it is now, so that liens come, it would become a lien in the order in which it's filed, as would be true for everything except tax liens.
Thank you, Representative Barnhart.
And that would require an additional change, I think.
And I think that is about the only one that is currently on the table. Committee members, anything else? Yes, Representative Betts.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And in following the remark from Mr. Co-Chair, is there something in here that imposes an obligation upon the senior to prove the value of the house so we know the amount of the equity available? I can't remember the question. I'm just asking. Yeah, in other words, can someone come and ask for the deferral and get it even though they have almost no equity in the house?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, there's no requirement for whether a senior would have or a disabled participant would have equity in their home. The requirement would simply be that they have lived in the home for 5 years. And assuming that they're paying a mortgage, they would have some equity in after 5 years.
This brings up an interesting question. Is the language that they've lived in the home or they have owned the home?
The language is that they lived in the home. So there's a possibility.
Well, we
have to fix that, too.
We may have to reconsider that, because I think the idea is that they would have lived in, that they would own the home. Thank you for bringing that up, Representative Benz.
Well, and Representative Benz raises, if I may, Madam Chair, raises a different issue, and that is some kind of expectation that the state might be repaid from the equity, but there has to be some in that case.
Well, I guess if I could push back a little bit here, let's solve, if this hasn't been a problem, let's not try and solve it. I think that the 5 years is the piece that puts enough equity in the house, because the property taxes on a house, I mean, we've limited the size of the property that we're going to be, you know, these are not high-value properties, I guess I'm saying. And so our obligations here, I don't think, are going to grow that great if after 5 years. Let's keep in mind what we're trying to do here. We're trying to keep some of our older citizens and our vulnerable citizens in their living situation. And we will get our money when the house is sold. I do think it's appropriate that it be more than they live in. However, I'm going to have to go back and look at what previous language was around this. I'm not sure that this also applies to the disabled community, and they would not necessarily own the home. So we might have to think a little deeper on that.
Well,
Christine, you want to respond to that?
Madam Chair, I think that they would own the home by the time they would apply for the deferral, because they would be the ones liable for the property tax. I don't think there could be a situation in which they might not own the home at the time that they apply, but it is possible that they could have lived in the home and just bought it within the last maybe 2 years or some period shorter than 5 years, and then go in for the deferral.
program.
That's what we envisioned, Mr. Chair.
I don't think it was either, but I think we may want to get LC to help us with this. I'm looking at the bottom of page 5 of the dash 3, which says the property, this is as amended, the property has been the homestead of the individual or individuals who filed a claim for deferral for at least 5 years preceding April 15th of the year in which the claim is filed. Except for an individual required to be absent from the homestead by reason of health. The definition of homestead is found on page 1, line 12. Homestead means the owner-occupied principal dwelling, either real or personal property, owned by the taxpayer and the tax lot in which it's located. If the homestead, well, and then it goes on to further define. It would seem, well, perhaps we'll get an answer to the implied question here.
We have our drafter here, and if you'd identify yourself and give us a thank you, Alan, for coming and for watching this discussion.
Yes, Alan Dale with Legislative Council, and the last thing I heard anyway was whether we needed to amend it to make sure that the individuals eligible to claim the deferral had to own the home.
Yes.
That's in the definition. I think this may be where Representative Barnhart was going. So homestead is defined to mean the owner-occupied principal dwelling. So, yes, they have to own the house. And then the lived in it for 5 years, that's on top of that, that they're required to have lived in it for at least 5 years.
So it could be their homestead, but they couldn't have had it be a rental for the last 5 years and then move in and take the deferral. They would have had to have lived in it.
Yes. Owner-occupied principal dwelling, I think, by itself means that they have to own it and live in it as their principal home.
Representative Benz, you started this discussion.
Right. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess the discussion is whether we understand that by adopting a loan program that pays no attention to equity, we have made a clear decision to subsidize those that don't have the equity. And are we doing so having some knowledge of how much of a financial obligation we're undertaking? And that's really my only question. I understand the purpose of the program. I just want to make sure that we have some general idea of how much risk we're taking as a result of not looking at equity. And I'm hoping that really hasn't been the issue that's led to where we are right now. There are some other solutions, but I don't think they fit the general goal that we're trying to attain. I mean, we could, as I mentioned once before, charge a higher rate of interest to take into account the additional risk. I don't think there's been any enthusiasm for that. And so I just want to get some general idea of how much we might have to additionally subsidize the program by virtue of this five-year device that designs how much or reflects how much or how little we care about the equity element of what we're doing.
I appreciate the discussion.
There are two more points. Again, Alan Dale, Legislative Council, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. And on page 5, section 3 begins, which amends 311-670. There was some rearrangement of the statutes that I did. So section 311-668 now deals with the eligibility of the individuals to claim the deferral, and section 311-670 deals with the eligibility of the homestead for the deferral. And page 6, beginning at line 3, new subsection 1B, it again says the individual claiming the deferral individually or jointly must own the fee simple estate. So there's the ownership requirement there again. And then there's also subsection 2, which requires that the homestead, the real market value of the homestead is a percentage of the county median real market value, which in every case as the ownership period increases, the percentage increases. So that might be one way of addressing the concern. If not, we can, of course, amend again.
Thank you.
Sure.
Further questions? Yes, Representative.
Very arcane legal question. I'm
okay.
concerned about the use of the word homestead.
Yes.
Because that's used in other places in the Oregon Revised Statutes to mean other things. Is there a way that we can tweak that to make it clear that we're talking about a homestead only for purposes of this section and so as not to confuse it with the homestead exemption or domicile?
Okay. Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Representative Wand, the definition section begins with the phrase as used in ORS 311-666 to 311-701, which is this deferral program. So the definition of homestead that appears in subsection 2 is only for this series in the ORS.
We haven't had any. I see that that's not a new portion of the bill, so we haven't had any problems with that with case law or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I can look
Thank
at
you.
That.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair.
Thank you. No. Things we have to get off the table. Okay. Representative?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm simply suggesting that members read this very carefully and thoroughly and ask LC any questions, because I'm hoping, and I suspect you are too, that we're going to be ready to move this one pretty soon.
And members, we haven't had much discussion on the 5% cap, but the anticipated growth in the senior population is 4%. So this gives us a little leeway under anticipate, but it also makes the numbers continue to work to bring this back into solvency, which is the really critical piece. The other option, of course, is to just stop this program. I think we want this program to work, and we want it to work for the targeted population that we're trying to help. But as Representative Bentz so appropriately says, we have to do it in a fiscally intelligent manner and not put the state at risk. I think that we're very close to there, and welcome, you know, you to all rethink it and mention anything else that you think promptly needs, because this is another one we need to get out the door. Thank you very much, Alan, for coming down. We appreciate your help. And with that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2543. Do you want to defer this one to... Anyone do with this one? This is yours.
Do you want to send it out?
Well, we don't have a fiscal.
Well, we don't have a fiscal. We have
okay.
to defer it anyway.
Okay, I'm going to open...
There's no reason to open it.
No, I'm not going to open. I am going to carry over House Bill 2546 to our next meeting, Friday, and open a work session on House Bill 3606.
Different than what he thought you were going to
Oops.
Say.
Well, that's the only one left. Yep. It's the only one left.
Oh, did she just open
it? Madam Co-Chair, I can also help give an update on this.
That would be very nice. Do you want to go down there or you want to do it here?
I think it would just be very
Okay,
brief.
Thank you.
Give an update. Chris can chime in as necessary. Colleagues, House Bill 3606 was the look back at some technical fixes of how the department has issued the Betsy in examining the bill in the Dash 1 amendment. Chris pointed out that there are a few places where the amendment and the bill didn't quite achieve what the proponents wanted it to achieve. I think the proponents truly wanted it to be a revenue-neutral relatively technical fix with one policy provision in it that we want to bring before the committee. We're working on a set of amendments to achieve that goal, so it's not quite ready yet, but when we're there, we'll be happy to present it before the committee.
Representative, is this something that would be better fit into the other bills before the Revenue Committee, more concerned with Betsy, or is this...
Madam Co-Chair, I think this is actually a bit of a separate issue because it deals almost entirely with, well, for example, the policy issue that is in the bill is an issue where the department had interpreted the rules around the Betsy one way for about 30 years.
Okay.
That was actually incorrect with regards to the statute, realized their error, and then changed to conform to statute. However, all proponents based on 30 years of history, or excuse me, all applicants based on about 30 years of history had believed that the law was one way when it was a fact another way. So this is looking back to clarify that issue, as well as to clarify some issues around certified costs versus other costs. So it really is a technical look back as opposed to any major change going forward.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would second that motion, that idea that this one deals with the past, and the rest of our discussion, complicated as they are looking forward.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And let's keep it right here and get it done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Further discussion on this?
Chris, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No, nope, that's what you had. Some said it pretty well. Yeah.
Thank you. We will close our work session on House Bill 3606. Now, by my reading, I've hit everything on our agenda. Paul, do you have something further for the committee?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that we have down what you're carrying forward.
We are carrying forward 2328,
okay. 3261. Okay.
We moved 2550A. We are carrying forward 2543,
okay,
and 2546.
Who's the carrier?
Bentz.
Oh, that's right. Representative Bentz.
Okay.
That's how, what I have.
That's what I got.
Okay. Thank you. With that, committee adjourns.